Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. Remember back with the movie Expelled, Ben Stein's great movie? His official website for the film announced a movie marathon that we were hosting, whereas members of our audience were set to watch the movie every showing on opening weekend. And I was one of the many who did that. It was so much fun. And the film opens on the lawn of the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. I practically have the whole script memorized. It was 15 times seeing that film. And the first scientist to come on with Ben Stein was Dr. Richard Sternberg, who was forced out at the Smithsonian. He was the managing editor of a scientific journal, the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington. He oversaw the publishing of a paper by, if I recall, Dr. Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute, and hence the movie Expelled. And what an honor to have one of the world's foremost geneticists on this program, Dr. Richard Sternberg. Dr. Sternberg, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Pleasure to be here.
You, I believe, Dr. Sternberg, are as up on the function of the human genome as any other scientist working today. You're now with the Discovery Institute, is that true?
I'm with the Biologic Institute and also with the Discovery Institute, yes. I'm a senior fellow with both institutes.
And they are part of the intelligent design movement. For full disclosure here at Bob Enyart Live and Real Science Radio, we're creationists. But we love the work done at the Discovery Institute and the Biologic Institute. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Sternberg, could we talk a bit about junk DNA? Because for decades, it was argued that one of the best pieces of evidence for Darwinism was that the human genome is filled with mostly junk, non-functioning segments. Could we talk through that argument and then what is the current state of the evidence?
Sure. That argument goes back to the 1976 book by Richard Dawkins titled The Selfish Gene. Mm-hmm. Dawkins did not propose the notion of junk DNA up front. What he argued is that he presented a very well-written, simplistic, radically nihilistic, and radically reductionistic picture of what genes are and what they do. And so the organism basically is just a vehicle to pass on your genes from one generation to the next. And a few years later, 1980, you had two papers come out in the journal Nature. It's considered the most prestigious scientific journal, but it was a pair of papers, one penned by Leslie Orgel and Francis Crick, Crick being, of course, of the DNA double helix fame, and the other paper by Carmen Sapienza and W4 Doolittle. Anyway, the two papers came out and they said, we can explain the vast excess or seeming excess of DNA sequences in the cell by reference to Dawkins's selfish gene. Mm. And their argument is that, okay, you've got those pieces of DNA that actually code for protein. Most don't. In the case of an average human cell, like a white blood cell,
right,
as if there is such a thing as an average cell, you know, roughly 98.5% of the DNA sequences do not code for protein. And their argument was that these sequences have no other explanation than that they are the selfish replicators who've been able to make copies of themselves over and over and over again. They're effectively junk with respect to having a functionality. They argued that because they've given an evolutionary explanation, there's no other explanation is needed to explain them. And that furthermore, to nail this doctrine to the ground, they argued that to search for functions would be an intellectually futile exercise. Mm. So by 1980, you had junk DNA as we know it. And if you go back and read the 1976 book by Dawkins, that's a radically atheistic treatise. The junk DNA notion was baptized into atheism early on.
Yeah, way back in the 1990s, this show, Bob Enyart Live, we've been on since April 1991, and we've had a number of evolutionists over the years make the junk DNA argument. I recall a caller, we created a YouTube video of a caller who said, well, hasn't Richard Dawkins proved Darwinism in his books? And Richard, I had the response that, well, his books really don't provide evidence. They just assume evolution to be true.
Correct.
And the funniest thing is when he came out with his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, he made a YouTube video promoting it, and he said, he almost quoted me verbatim by accident, and he said, my previous books provided no evidence for evolution. I only assumed it to be true, which was really quite a kick. We enjoyed that. You've heard of, I imagine, Eugenie Scott, the founder of the National Center for Science Education.
Indeed I have, yes.
Well, she picked up this argument 8 years after those journal Nature papers. In 1998, I got to interview her, and we were on the air for an hour, and I asked her for her best evidence for Darwinism and or against creation.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the question specifically was, what's the best evidence that higher functions have evolved, like flight or vision or so on?
Sure.
So I have a quote, an audio clip from that conversation. I'm wondering if it's okay with you, because it's about junk DNA.
By all means.
Oh, great. Please. It's about almost 3 minutes long, so let's hear that, and then I'd love to get your comments.
All right.
Actually, I want to finish off what I was starting to say when we had to break for that commercial.
Yeah.
And that was when we were talking about evidence for evolution versus evidence for special creation. And I wanted to ask you about something called pseudogenes, which are sections of genetic material that don't have any function. If they were turned on, they would just put out gibberish because they don't have any, they don't code for any real proteins or any enzymes or anything like that. Why is it that you find pseudogenes that have exactly the same sequence of amino acid bases in closely related forms, but you don't find them in distantly related forms?
Eugenie, it took scientists a century to figure out what some of the higher structures in the human anatomy do. What do they do? Like the pituitary gland. It's somewhat conceited of us to say we fully understand genetics and we know that this material has no function.
If we are clever enough to be able to sequence a protein so that we know the exact order of amino acids and we know exactly what that protein does, that protein is not doing something else. It's not our ignorance. It's the lack of willingness to admit that this is a non-functioning protein.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think on the subject of genetics and what different genes and bits of information in the DNA code for and what they do not code for, do you think we have most of that knowledge, or do you think we are still to gain most of the knowledge of understanding how genetics works?
There's a lot of knowledge that we still have, that we still are learning about all the time.
Right.
But that's irrelevant. That's irrelevant to pseudogenes.
Eugenie, maybe we could set up a ground rule for every question of yours that I answer, maybe you'd answer one of mine.
Still trying to answer your first one.
Eugenie, do you think we have most of the knowledge that there is to possess about genetics, or do you think we're mostly still in the dark with the majority of the knowledge still to come?
Oh, I think we're over the hump.
Oh, you think
I think
know
there's
more,
plenty more to
Eugenie?
Learn, but we got the basics.
Okay, Eugenie, this is what I want to do. I want to date this, 1998, May 5th. Eugenie Scott, a degreed scientist, has said...
All right, so Dr. Sternberg, I'm a talk show host and I'm a Bible pastor,
mm-hmm.
pastor of a Denver Bible church. I'm not a geneticist. Eugenie is a PhD physical anthropologist.
Right.
So fast forward now to 2015. Science has showed which position to be more accurate.
Well, I would definitely say yours.
Well, that...
I mean, in listening to what she was saying, she was making several arguments. One is presenting that pseudogenes, quote unquote pseudogenes, are non-functional. And then dovetailing that with, of course, the argument for common descent. And then she proffered that, yes, we're, you know, by that date, 1998, we had pretty much amassed the majority, the evidence about the nature of the genome. And I think that she's wrong in all three counts. I can explain why, but, well, I would, let's say, I'll put the table to common descent. I don't have a beef with common descent, as others may. But the pseudogene and that...
Dr. Sternberg, if I could explain to the audience, the intelligent design movement argues that there must be intelligence behind life, but that in and of itself does not dispute common descent. And so Stephen Meyer makes that point many times. And while I do, that's another matter to address.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But going back to the first point is that our knowledge circa 1998 was quite limited relative to the knowledge we have today and relative to the knowledge we're going to have 6 months from now. Because we are, and I've said this before, we're drowning in a sea of empirical data. I mean, they're sequencing genomes left, right, and center of all kinds of organisms, animals, plants, bacteria, viruses. They are exploring functions and or non-functions in ways that simply no one had thought of in 1998. So you want to look at our knowledge circa 1998. It was quite limited in comparison to today. But we knew, if you really looked hard at the evidence, we knew, or at least I'll say this, and I do not want to come across as sounding arrogant, but I was convinced, certainly by the early 1990s, and even earlier than that, that many of the so-called non-functional DNA sequences indeed had coding functions. All you really had to do is just spend time surveying the available data. That, of course, is a rather wearisome enterprise. But certainly, pseudogenes have been put front and center as an example of, first of all, genes that lack any functionality. In 1998, you could have made that argument and gotten away with it. Francis Collins made that argument as late as 2006. But we now know, based on both genetic studies based on experimental studies, that many so-called pseudogenes, yes, they don't code for proteins. On the other hand, they do have important roles in chromosome biology, such as the way a chromosome fiber folds, or they are produced into RNAs that are then spliced, and those RNAs in turn regulate other RNAs that make other proteins. So individuals who are studying pseudogenes now are reticent to call them pseudogenes. In fact, you'll see papers to the effect of pseudogenes, meaning that, you know, they appear to be pseudogenes, but they're really not pseudogenes. So that argument of hers, I think, is defunct. As for having, by circa 1998, having pretty much well established that our empirical database had been, you know, constructed for the most part, we know that's simply not to be the case because of the ENCODE project and the ModEncode project, that they both are still underway.
The ENCODE project, when they released their massive papers through the journal Nature a couple of years ago, we, of course, celebrated on Real Science Radio that there are hundreds of researchers working in concert around the world, and they're identifying that these sections of the human DNA that were thought to be junk, useless, that at least are being transcribed into RNA.
Right.
And then there is an effort underway to find out then what might this RNA be doing. If there was no function, you'd think that evolution over time would purge out that useless transcribing. But
right,
they are being transcribed. So it seems that they were finding that if there were mutations in the junk, that they could lead to disease. They could be debilitating. So
right,
they thought, well, it looks like it's not junk. Might not be functionless. And the fact that so much, 80% as of a couple of years ago, had been documented that the cell is doing something with this DNA.
That's right, yes.
And so that was, we celebrated that because that seemed to be an affirmation that there's a lot more brilliance in our genome than the suspected 2% that really is doing anything?
Well, the ENCODE results, the first round of the ENCODE results, were published in 2007. And it's interesting because the first round was published with Francis Collins as being the head of the Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, where I was also located at the time. And the curious thing is that the argument was being made that, I mean, up until 2006, that of course, well, you know, we look at the 98.5% of human sequences and almost comparable amounts in the mouse and in other organisms, and we find that, you know, there doesn't appear to be functionality. 2007 rolls around, and the surprise was that most of the activity is taking place in that 98% that does not code for protein. And when I use that word activity, I do not mean that it's, you know, you're going from DNA to RNA. I mean it's being spliced, it's being edited, it's being moved around and used in a number of different ways. And it was a surprise. But the conclusion, and this came from the National Human Genome Research Institute, at the time Collins was there, it said, you know, the term junk DNA should no longer be used. That it's an, you know, a term that, as of that date, had no meaning. Of course, many people, including Collins, would not let go of it. So, yeah, the ENCODE, the first round of the ENCODE results surprised people simply because most of the activity, most of the intriguing pathways that are taking place in the cell, that is in the nucleus of a human cell, are taking place with the sequences that were dismissed as flotsam and jetsam. Mm. And when they looked at the fruit fly and they looked at the roundworm and some other model organisms, they found the very same pattern. Now, the counter argument, this is an argument that I think someone like Eugenie Scott would make, would say, well, yes, but the human sequences are, you know, these are unique to humans. The mouse sequences are unique to mouse. They're not conserved, and therefore they really are junk. Well, the fact is that when you look at how they are being used, you look at how they're distributed along the genome, what you find is that they may be species-specific, but their patterns are highly non-random. Mm-hmm. And that's something we've known since the early 1980s. In fact, you can line up the human-specific sequences, the so-called junk regions, and mouse so-called junk regions, and rat so-called junk regions. And they're species-specific, but yet it's almost the same graph.
And for the audience, perhaps I should have done this earlier, but we've been talking about genetics and junk DNA for decades on this show.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Sternberg, for the audience members who are not quite following, a stretch of genetic letters on our DNA, sequence of amino acids,
mm-hmm.
It used to be believed that a sequence coded for a protein, which led to a function.
Right.
So one sequence, one protein, one function.
That's right.
That has been just completely destroyed.
Well, it has been destroyed. I mean, I can give you the most extreme example.
Sure.
Of where you've got, quote unquote, one stretch of DNA and the number of proteins you can produce from is off scale. And that's it's a gene found in the fruit fly. So the humble fruit fly you find buzzing around your bananas in the kitchen, he or she has it. It's called DSCAM, D-S-C-A-M. From that one stretch of DNA, 38,016 different proteins are produced.
38,016. So that if you think of an amino acid sequence as a recipe,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have friends come over for dinner,
right.
You can take one recipe on a sheet of paper, and there's some scribbles at the bottom. And from those scribbles, you could use that recipe to make 38,000 different dishes, depending on who's coming over for dinner.
That's right. Through alternatively using parts. Imagine it's like you're given a very large menu, And, you know, you can select, you can mix and match salads and entrees and appetizers and desserts and, you know, you name it, and you can come up with 38,000, 16 different, you know, full course meals. It's similar to that. The different types do have a function. They're required for nerve cell functionalities. But that's just one example. You have other examples of where, and this has been recently found, although again, here's something, we've known this since the late 1980s. You have some organisms like protozoans. They do not inherit protein coding DNA sequences. In other words, what's passed on to them is not a, you know, these nice genetic sentences ordered into paragraphs, ordered into chapters, ordered into books that they can, so to speak, you know, say, oh yes, now I'm going to make protein X. What they have to do, and they do it on a major scale, is they have to de novo, which, you know, it means from scratch. They have to piece together and make their protein coding genes. Hmm. Believe it or not. Very well established. It's a phenomenal result.
These are unicellular organisms.
They're unicellular, but they're very big. I mean, some of them, like a paramecium, although paramecium does it on a smaller scale, these are single-celled eukaryotes. That mean they're nucleated organisms.
They have a nucleus.
Some of them, they simply do not pass on what we would call genes. What they pass on is gibberish, although it's really not gibberish.
Right.
What they do is they piece it together in different ways so that they can make literally thousands to tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of genes.
Oh, my. So that, Richard, there is a code above the level of the code in the genome that we saw originally coded for proteins.
Right.
So that there's actually, I used to work for Microsoft in Redmond, Washington. I'm embarrassed to admit. No, just but there are codes on top of codes on top of codes, so that the sophistication is bewildering. When Bill Gates said that the human DNA is a programming language that's far more complex than anything man has ever created, our knowledge then was still juvenile compared to what we've learned since he said that. And it continues to astound us, not just this complexity, but something different, the sophistication of it all.
Well, it goes beyond. I mean, yes, to use that word is a gross understatement, because even the genetic code itself can be rewired. An example is that, well, there was just a paper came out the other day about, again, the fruit fly. When the flies are in certain stressful conditions, what they will do is they will reconfigure their genetic code. That is how RNA letters are converted into amino acid letters. But then again, we know yeast can do it. So if you have to rewrite the code on the fly, no pun intended, you know, it can be done, and it's done in real time. And I'm not aware of anything like that in computer science.
No. Right. Self-modifying code was banned back in the 50s and 60s. Because it's so confounding and confusing and impossible to manage, to think through. And our genomes are doing that, and there's a million genomes to a million organisms, different kinds of organisms,
right,
are doing that on the fly.
Well, they're doing it on the fly. They can do it very rapidly. And this is why what got me interested in the whole junk DNA argument, just to bring it back, and I do have points that in you had an individual, a lady who was a genius who studied the corn plant. She won the Nobel Prize for investigations in 1983. Her Nobel lecture was published in 1984. She studied what, I'm sure you've seen it, Indian corn, you know, the corn that's multicolored.
Yes.
It's got spots and stripes. And through her patient endeavors, she inferred that the genome can reorganize itself in an intelligent way. And so that was the essence of her Nobel lecture. And she argued, when you look at the evidence, and this is early 1980s, that there are systems that we call today smart systems or intelligent systems. They're systems that can, some have called them anticipatory systems. That would be the formal term for them. They can anticipate the future, and they can self-modify. And in computing theory, of course, you know, the investigations of them are largely on paper, and they are very hard to manage. You certainly don't want to buy an operating system that is going to do its own anticipation, and
right.
You know what I mean?
Self-modify.
Yeah, yeah. Self-modify in a way that you may not want.
Right. OS 10.
Right.
Yeah, be scary, right.
Yeah. But based on just studying corn, she inferred that, and her colleague was working with bacteria, inferred the very same thing from studying, you know, E. coli. That was James Shapiro, who had first isolated one of these so-called jumping genes that were categorized as junk DNA. And he concluded the same thing, that you've got these systems, and they enable self-modification. But self-modification, that he wouldn't say this, I don't think. Certainly he's no intelligent design friend or proponent,
no.
But modify them in an end-directed manner.
Dr. Sternberg, we're almost out of time. If I could ask you two last questions.
Of course.
The ENCODE results in 2012, they weren't warmly received by many in the Darwinist camp, like the Richard Dawkins of the world. But you have quoted one Darwinist who said, if ENCODE is correct, then Darwinism is false. Could
yes.
you tell us that story?
Yes. The individual I was referring to is Dan Grauer, but he's one of several who are adamantly opposed to the ENCODE project, and they were especially opposed to it after the results came out in 2012, as you had this flotilla of articles in top-tier journals like Genome Research, Nature. And if you read those papers and you browse through the data, well, it's shocking. They proposed a definition of a gene that is, and I'm almost quoting it, it's that it's a higher order polyfunctional entity that assumes different forms under different cellular regimes.
Mm.
And they furthermore go on to state, to add insult to injury, that the definition of a gene will eventually be divorced from some specific
sequence.
DNA substrate. Yes, sequence.
Right.
So it's going to be something of a higher order polyfunctional. And actually, if you go back to 2007, the first round of the ENCODE results had made it clear that the old gene definition, the one you would find, say, you know, in 1987, is no longer useful, because you got RNAs. No one knows where RNAs start and stop. They're all over the place. They're on both strands. And then again, I mentioned like D-SCAM. You get one stretch, 38,016 different proteins.
Mm.
So one gene, one enzyme is out of the model. And this is a problem. This is a problem because for a neo-Darwinian, someone like Eugenie Scott, the picture that we had from the 1920s and 1930s was it. And then, of course, you get the Watson-Crick model, and the one gene, one enzyme, and there it is. We've got the model. And now we can get, evolution to work. ENCODE comes along, and the results of ENCODE, taken at face value, are as radical as some of the results that came out in physics in the early part of the 20th century, if not before, where the old Rutherford atom was shown to be, not the whole picture. You needed quantum mechanics to begin to really understand what's going on at the atomic level. Well, ENCODE has done something like that, in the sense that it says our old picture of a gene as being this particle that can be mutated and that, fits comfortably within our paradigm, that gene doesn't exist. It's like the Rutherford atom. And so if you're a population geneticist, and if you're someone who's absolutely convinced that that's the only game in town, then you're going to find the ENCODE results deeply disturbing.
Mm.
And so they're opposed to it. They're opposed to it for axiomatic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it seems that my second question was the way that science has been harmed. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, Plato's Republic, he ended his republic with a view of the cosmos with the Earth stationary in the center and then the sun, moon, and the planets and the stars orbiting the Earth. That geocentrism was proposed by many, Aristotle, Ptolemy, and until some of the Christian scientists like Kepler and Copernicus and so on, Isaac Newton, got their hands on reforming all that, science was really, astronomy was almost stillborn because of that false notion of geocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
Come forward to the last half a century, it seems that the Darwinist claim that this stuff is all junk. And as you said earlier, in 1980, was it, with those papers in the journal Nature,
right,
that even to look for function shows a foolishness that shouldn't be tolerated among scientists.
Especially not funded.
And not funded.
And yeah, that's the key word, yeah.
And so junk DNA will likely go down as one of the greatest science stoppers in biology, but maybe in all of science, for the period of enormous growth that we've had in the last half century in fundamental science discovery, whereas in genetics, we were held back by this non-intelligent design paradigm.
Well, I would say, I'm not sure if it would be the prime example of a science stopper. I think certainly the arguments presented in 1980 by Doolittle and Sapienza, where they said it's intellectually, you know, a waste of time, that to me, that is definitely a science stopper. I think it is an example of two things. One, of how when you have a doctrine that is set up to be effectively a Procrustean bed, you know, it just lops off any limbs or head, whatever, that is not going to fit within it, then you have a problem. And it's, to my way of thinking, and I've said this in print, that's what neo-Darwinism has been effectively with respect to genetics. Mm. On the other hand, though, it's the curiosity of researchers. I mean, the fact of the matter is that most biologists do not wake up in the morning thinking about evolutionary theory. They don't think about it at lunch, maybe not, you know, at bedtime. They just go about doing good science. Mm. That's the majority of them. And it's because of that that you have these interesting results out there. Mm. So, yes, you have a handful of people on the one hand who would present a one-size-fits-all, very restrictive, drunk-under-the-lamppost picture of science, and they're kicking and screaming. They do not like the results of ENCODE. But on the other hand, you have intrepid researchers that they're just interested in solving interesting problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to give credit to the human spirit, to our drive for knowledge.
Well, and the army of the 440 authors of the ENCODE results in 2012.
Yes.
And a growing army all over the world. The data is a friend of the intelligent design movement. That seems clear.
Well, I would say that the intelligent design movement is one that arose, I mean, you know, it's disparaged as being creationism in a, you know, what, a leisure suit or a cheap tuxedo or something like that. Actually, what led me in that direction is simply by looking at the evidence and comparing it with the alternatives. And that's not to say that the ENCODE researchers or the others are latent ID supporters. I don't think that at all. I would say that they provide great grist for the ID conceptual mill.
Yeah. It's an honor to have you on the program, Dr. Sternberg. We're excited about your work with the Discovery Institute. Is there an especially good way for the audience to keep up with the latest from your research?
Well, I'm currently in the process of wrapping up a number of projects. I would say to pay attention to the Biologic Institute website.
All right.
And or the Discovery Institute website, and that when they are out, they'll not be hard to find.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for joining us. It is an honor. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Richard Sternberg.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
And so that was, wow, the scientist who opened Ben Stein's movie expelled on the lawn of the Smithsonian, having been basically ousted for daring to publish as an editor to see through the publishing of a paper on intelligent design. So we invite you to share this program with your friends. Just go to realscienceradio.com, that's realscienceradio.com, or rsr.org, and may God bless you.